This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
But with that, thank you for attending The World's Looming Nuclear Threats. As dire as that title sounds, I'm sure this is going to be a hopeful conversation. And I will leave it to our panelists to introduce themselves, share whatever you'd like to share, and then you can dive right into your remarks.
Want to go first?
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for everybody for coming out today. Wasn't the most exciting, you know, title. You're coming to a afternoon thriller. But hopefully we can have a good discussion and talk a little bit about the multiple threats we face because of nuclear technologies. My name is Joshua Frank. I'm a journalist and co-editor of Counterpunch, which is a co-sponsor of this event along with Verso and Science for the People, so shout out to them. And Ramana can talk about Verso. He has a new book out, which is fantastic. And yeah, nuclear is not the solution. It's available down at the bookstore and anywhere you can find good books. I'm going to start out by talking about a threat that we don't often hear about. You'll hear throughout this conference, we're talking about Palestine, right? We're talking about Gaza. We're talking about the genocide that's going on. But very rarely, if ever, do we talk about this looming threat of nuclear technology that Israel has. Israel has never admitted to having nuclear weapons, but they have a stockpile. And we're going to get into that a little bit. We often hear about other threats, though, right? We hear about China, we hear about North Korea, we hear about Russia. That's in the West, right? And those, of course, are threats. But we don't often talk about the other threats that we face from our allies. France, we have nuclear weapons. UK has nuclear weapons. But, of course, it's the countries that we don't agree with that are always the problem, right? And, of course, we don't hear about Israel. Israel has never admitted to have nuclear weapons. They've never allowed any inspectors into their plants. And they have a long history of deception dating back to their early development. And soon after Israel became a state in the 1950s, they began a nuclear program, a secret nuclear program that they did in co-sponsorship with France. The U.S. and the Eisenhower administration didn't know about this until the 1960s. And was pretty stunned that this was going on under the radar, essentially. The first plant that they produced that is still operating today is called Dimona. It's very similar to the Hanford plant in the United States, which is the first plutonium production plant for atomic weapons. Hanford, in the case in the U.S., is a long-standing disaster and produced plutonium throughout the Cold War and ended in the 1980s. Unfortunately, we don't know exactly the extent to which Dimona in Israel is producing plutonium. We have evidence from satellites that as recently as 2019, they had expanded Dimona. So we think that they are actively producing more and more nuclear weapons. And their arsenal estimates range from 80 to 200. But again, without letting inspectors in, we don't really have a really good idea. And of course, early on, they lied about this. When the U.S. first learned about it, they said, oh, wait, you know, this is just for peaceful purposes, for energy, not for weapons. So don't worry about it, right? Well, that turned out to be a complete lie. As we know, with a lot of the policies of the Israeli government, they like to lie in order to cover up the truth, and such is the case with their atomic weapons. They refused to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1975, the Biological Weapons Convention, and I think more importantly, that something else that a lot of people don't know about is that in 1979, in conjunction with South Africa, they held a secret nuclear blast off the coast of South Africa. This was an illegal testing of an atomic explosion, and it was a violation of the 1963 Limited Test Ban Treaty, which Israel was a party of. This violation was covered up, and to this day, we don't have the full story of what happened. Of course, the CIA and the US government has information about this, but at the time, the Carter administration wasn't even privy to this explosion happening. And at the same time, South Africa, during that period, was also had a secret nuclear program, and of course, it was an apartheid South Africa at that time. So this violation, it also violated the Glenn Amendment to the U.S. Arms Export Control. And I bring that up because it sounds kind of technical, but because Israel violated that amendment, all arms shipments to Israel by the U.S. after 1979, after that test, are illegal, which means all weapons shipments to Israel, the billions and billions of dollars weapons shipments over the last few decades, including, of course, the most recent exports of weapons, are illegal. And the president, in this case Biden, is obligated to uphold that ban, but of course has not done that. No president has done that. I believe, and Ramana and Ray may be able to correct me, but I think the last president to actually enact the Glenn Amendment was Clinton, during the testing of India and Pakistan and their testing. So it has been, the Glenn Amendment actually has been used to put a halt to weapons exports and weapons support. So this, I believe, is an inroad for us trying to fight for a pre-Palestine, to pressure the next administration, whoever it may be, to uphold the Glenn Amendment and stop weapons shipments. We also know that, of course, Israel is violating numerous human rights violations and laws, including shipping weapons to a country that has made it impossible for aid of food and other things to be entered into Gaza. So there's multiple fronts we can go legally to stop these exports, and I believe the Glenn Amendment, going back to this testing in the South Atlantic, is a precedent for that. But I also want to kind of talk a little bit about some hopefulness too, because this is a looming danger, and you know, the Glenn Amendment is one kind of like thing that we can talk about, but South Africa at the end of apartheid dismantled their nuclear arsenal. It was the only country ever to voluntarily do so that had the technology to do so. So there's also precedent for an apartheid state, which Israel is an apartheid state, to end their weapons production and dismantle their arms. I believe that in order for us to have a truly free Palestine, we need to have a nuclear-free Israel, one that is free of weapons. And these threats are immense, right? We know what's going on with Hezbollah and Israel. We know that there's increased threats with Iran and Israel, and I don't think that anybody in this room or at this conference would argue with the fact that Netanyahu is unhinged. I don't think that anybody would have even predicted that this genocide would have gone on so long. I believe that if Netanyahu believes that he's cornered, that he could use a nuclear weapon in some capacity against Iran or another enemy. I hate to think that that's a possibility, but everything's been a target during this genocide. Everything. Schools, journalists, everything. There's no reason to believe that he's incapable of using such a device. And of course, we've heard people within the government call for using a nuclear weapon on Gaza. And you know, we can go on and on about the genocide itself. But I think underpinning that genocide is nuclear technology, and I believe that Israel is continuing to violate international norms and international treaties so they can get away with genocide and this continued apartheid government. But again, going back to South Africa, I think there's a precedent for a nuclear-armed country to disarm and end apartheid, and I believe that we have to, as a galvanizing left force, to bring this into the conversation when we're talking about a free Palestine. Because I think it's paramount that we address the fact that Israel is a nuclear-armed state. Whether or not they abide by the norms of the international community, allow inspectors in and anything, we know that they have weapons, we know that they've tested weapons illegally, and it's a huge threat. So I just hope that we can walk away from this conversation and go into our other conversations throughout the weekend and talk about this, because it's very, very important. But of course, this is also linked to the power that the U.S. has, right? We are hypocritical in our own program. Of course, everybody else is a threat and not our own arsenal, even though we're the only country to ever use this on a civilian population. So we also need to be talking about that as well. And non-proliferation is a global effort. And it's a global movement, and Israel needs to be held accountable just like any other state. So I hope we can have a good conversation about that aspect of it. Ray, I can pass it over to Ray. They're going to talk a little bit about the global problem of proliferation, and then Ramana is going to talk about nuclear power and its connections to atomic weapons as well. So thanks so much.
Thanks, Josh. Can everybody hear me with my mask on? Yes. It's like, okay, cool. I'm going to keep it on then. So I'm Ray Atchison. I'm an organizer with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. My pronouns are they, them. I run WILP's disarmament program and have for almost 20 years now, so I've been in this space for a long time. I have a book with Haymarket Books, thanks to Rory Fanning and others at Haymarket for pushing that through, called Abolishing State Violence, A World Without Bombs, Borders, and Cages, which tries to connect up the nuclear weapons issue with also the structures of state violence, of policing and prisons and borders, capitalism and surveillance and war, and look at the abolitionist movements also that confront these structures of state violence. And I also have another book called Banning the Bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy, which I hope is an interesting title for some of you, which looks at the process of the anti-nuclear movement to prohibit nuclear weapons through international law. But I'm not really going to talk about either of those books today. What I'm going to do is focus a little bit on the money-making from the global nuclear enterprise and talk a little bit about what's happening in the United States right now with nuclear weapons. Do folks know roughly how many nuclear weapons are in the world right now? Does anybody want to shout out some guesses? Yeah.
About 10,000.
Very close, yeah. A little higher. Anybody else? No? Okay, so it's a little over 12,000 nuclear weapons in the world. This is obviously down from the height of the Cold War in the 80s, which was like 80,000 nuclear weapons. But what's happening right now is we're in a process where even while the numbers have dropped of actual warheads, all of the 9 nuclear armed states are engaged in what's called modernization program, which is very euphemistic language for rebuilding their arsenals, designing new types of nuclear warheads, designing new types of delivery systems like missiles and bombers and submarines to deploy these weapons. And so all of this, as you can imagine, is a money-making enterprise. It's mostly the same corporations that are building the weapons, that are going to Israel to commit genocide, that are going to other countries around the world to fuel armed conflict. These same companies like Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, all of the companies that so many of us fight against in different struggles, they're also building nuclear weapons. And about a little less than 300 financial institutions globally invest money in these private corporations. So we're talking billions and billions of dollars. Last year in 2023, about $83 billion from best estimates was spent on nuclear weapons globally, but there's hundreds of billions of dollars in shares and bonds within the companies making these weapons. And of course, it's not just the weapons themselves, right? Private corporations are also the ones operating uranium mines, extracting the uranium, operating the facilities that process it into plutonium, operating the nuclear waste dump sites, and failing to contain nuclear waste globally. And so these are all different issues of nuclear weapons that don't get talked about, all of these hidden bits and pieces that also make money for private contractors and profiteers. And all of them, of course, have an undue influence over government policy about the quote-unquote necessity for nuclear weapons. So all of these companies have lobbyists. All of these companies have think tanks that they pay to generate ideas about nuclear deterrence and geostrategic stability and all those things that we read about in textbooks or hear about on the news. And so really this is all an example that I think is equivalent to the state capture that we can see with, say, the fossil fuel industry and these other big corporate interests that then design policy. And so I wanted to focus just a little bit on the United States and give just two really clear examples of the type of modernization that's happening right now. So the first one I want to talk about is this thing called the Sentinel program. So the United States has intercontinental ballistic missiles, about 400 of them, across five states in the US. So they're in Colorado, they're in Wyoming, Nebraska, Montana, and North Dakota. And this is where they've got those big silos under the ground and these enormous missiles, and they've got warheads on these missiles, and when they launch them, they can go to Russia, to China, to North Korea, et cetera. So that's that situation. These are the sitting duck missiles. And the entire strategy around having these missiles in these states is that they are actually intended targets for an enemy strike. So the technical concept that nuclear war planners in this country use is called the nuclear sponge. So is anybody here from one of those states? All right, okay, so you live in the nuclear sponge, and your state is one of the ones that is intended to soak up the effects of a nuclear war and to be the target for a strike from, say, Russia, for example. Any strike would annihilate all life in the surrounding regions, so not just those states, but all the neighbors, and would contaminate agricultural land for decades, as well as water, of course, plants and animals. There would be millions of fatalities. Contamination would spread to most of the contiguous United States, plus Canada and northern Mexico. And so this is really a prime example of what we mean when we talk about a sacrifice zone. And we're going to have another panel tomorrow focusing on ending sacrifice zones with Janine Yazzie sitting in the audience and others tomorrow at 10 a.m. And I just wanted to emphasize as well that within these five states, there is the one example in the United States of missiles that are situated on a reservation. And so what happened in this case, the Fort Berthold Reservation of the Mendan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, and what happened was folks were dispossessed, displaced from this land, and it was stolen by the government. And then the government in the 1960s built a missile silo on the land. And then in the 1970s, there was a court case saying that these folks had the right to return to this land, and it was incorporated within the reservation. But now there was a missile silo on it. Did they tell people about this? No. Some of the elders apparently knew, but most people in the community living on the reservation had no idea there was a missile silo on their land. They knew there was some government installation that they weren't allowed to go near, but didn't know that it had hundreds of warheads on missiles. And so this, I think, is really important for us to think about in relation to what's going on with this Sentinel program right now. So for the past many decades, these have been, just for a little wonky thing, Minuteman III missiles. You may have heard of this in movies, but it's going to be replaced by this Sentinel thing. So they're replacing all 400 of these missiles across all five of these states, billions of dollars. And it relates to the second example that I want to talk about that's going on in the U.S. right now, which is the expansion of the Los Alamos Nuclear Weapon Lab, which is where the cores for the warheads on these missiles are going to be built. So you've probably all heard of Los Alamos, especially if you've seen the new film Oppenheimer, Gag. if you've had to sit through Oppenheimer. But Los Alamos, as the birthplace of the bomb, is still an active national nuclear laboratory. And it's part of what they do there is build the plutonium pits for the nuclear warheads in the United States. The U.S. has decided to replace all of these plutonium cores for its nuclear weapons. And so it is massively expanding its capacity to do this at Los Alamos. Now, Los Alamos is already a place that has a long history from its very beginning of dispossession, of course, of the native population, of the Latinx populations that lived there, contaminations, leaks, accidents, fires. Everything that could go wrong has gone wrong at Los Alamos. People have been harmed, there have been cover-ups. And so despite all of this, of course, and despite dealing with the legacy of that lab, they're expanding that lab. And so now what we're seeing in this area of New Mexico is massive construction, traffic, and this influx, again, of billions of dollars going towards the lab. Which is situated, Los Alamos is one of the 10 richest counties in the United States. New Mexico is, I think, the second or third poorest state in the United States. Española, which is the town right next to Los Alamos, is extremely impoverished, facing all kinds of inequalities, and a lot of it is due from the theft of the land from the local population, from the native population and the Latinx folks that lived there. And then the disparity in wealth that we see in the service economy that has built up around Los Alamos. And so again, this is the reason I'm emphasizing these two modernization programs, there are endless others we could talk about, is just to give a picture of the knock-on effects. So it's never just about the nuclear weapon. It's also about the communities that are affected. It's about the money being spent on this. It's about the people's lives that are impacted by these programs that to many of us seem very obscure and out of touch of our day-to-day reality as we're engaged with so many of our other struggles, but actually have a deep impact on any of the work for social justice that we might be doing across this country or elsewhere in the world. So I think I'll stop there for now and turn it over to Ramana. Thanks.
Thank you, Ray. I'm gonna take off my mask. Thank you. So my name is Ramana. I teach at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, and I obsess about all kinds of nuclear things. And I'm here partly because Wirso was nice enough to publish a book of mine called Nuclear is Not the Solution, Why Atomic Power is Not a Solution to Climate Change. But that's not what I'm going to talk about. I can mention that if it comes up later on. But I'm going to start with that because both Josh and Ray talked about why nuclear weapons are a bad thing, right? And here, I would assume most people would think it's a bad thing. We need to get rid of nuclear weapons. We need to have disarmament. Even some of the people who build these nuclear weapons might agree with that, right? But what they would say is, like Obama said, that we need to get rid of nuclear weapons, but as long as there are nuclear weapons anywhere in the world, we are going to have the best of them, right? And so many of these companies are seeking to make money at that time, but at least they would make a gesture towards getting rid of nuclear weapons. There are many problems to getting rid of nuclear weapons, and we can go into that later, but one of the challenges is the fact that simultaneously with trying to talk about getting rid of nuclear weapons, many countries are also involved in promoting the technology that makes possible making nuclear weapons, i.e. nuclear energy. Okay? I'll talk about sort of five different connections between these. I sort of talk about most of that in my book. But to start with, you know, Josh mentioned Hanford, where the first nuclear reactor was built anywhere in the world. And it was built to produce plutonium that was used in nuclear weapons in the Manhattan, part of the Manhattan Project. The first nuclear weapon was exploded in New Mexico on July 16, 1945, the Trinity test, contaminating a whole bunch of people who had no idea this was going to happening to them, and they were never told for a very, very long time. And they still haven't been compensated for that. And then the other use for that plutonium that was produced in Hanford was the nuclear weapon that was dropped on the city of Nagasaki in Japan. And this Hanford plant was the prototype for other nuclear reactors made around the world. And then there are other designs that were built by other participants in the Manhattan Project. In particular, Canada, where I live, was an important player in the Manhattan Project, and they pioneered a design called the heavy water reactor. And they built one near Ottawa in a place called Chalk River. And that design they gave to India as it was called the Canada-India reactor, and then the United States supplied heavy water for that reactor, so that reactor became was called CIRUS, Canada-India reactor, United States. And India used that nuclear reactor to initially, again, the Indian program was set up in 1948 to develop atomic energy for peaceful purposes. That was in its mandate, right? And even when they got the CIRUS reactor, and subsequently a few years later, they also managed to use some of the information that was put out as part of Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace program in the 1950s to figure out how to extract plutonium from the spent fuel in the CIRUS reactor. And I'll talk about the importance of that extraction process later on. To make the plutonium that was first used in India's first nuclear weapons test in 1974 in a place called Pokhran, which is not far from the border with Pakistan. Now, till that point, till 1974, India had always been saying its nuclear energy program was for peaceful purposes. And in fact, even the extraction of the plutonium, they justified by saying, we are setting up something called a fast breeder reactor program, and that requires the use of plutonium in the core, and that's what we are doing this for. It's only when the explosion happened in 1974 that you could see what the real purpose was. And of course, even at that point, what the Indian government said was this was not a nuclear weapons explosion. This was a peaceful nuclear explosion. Okay? Now, if that sounds like an oxymoron, it was. There is absolutely no difference in any meaningful sense, except that that design was not really optimized for being able to put on a missile and deliver it elsewhere. It's a large design. Anyway, so there is this long history, and you know, Josh talked about Israel having received a nuclear reactor design from France, and so on and so forth. All these countries have sort of learned from each other in multiple ways. And they have been, you know, the proliferators of nuclear weapons technology, the countries which have nuclear weapons. So there's this long historical connection. The second connection, which is kind of obvious if you look at it, is geography, right? So the International Atomic Energy Agency, the official body that's supposed to safeguard nuclear reactors and at the same time also promote nuclear energy technology for peaceful purposes, the IAEA, when I checked last a few weeks ago, lists around 440 reactors as operable reactors. Not all of them are operating right now, but these are the ones that are deemed as can be operated. Of the 440, roughly around 280 reactors are in countries with nuclear weapons. The United States has the most, 90 odd reactors that are operating in the United States. You know, France, China, Russia is the biggest exporter of nuclear power plants everywhere. It also has nuclear weapons. China is the biggest builder of nuclear reactors in its own country. It has nuclear weapons, India, all of them. And now if you add to these the countries that have military alliances with nuclear weapon states, such as Canada, where I live, or Japan, right? Then the overlap is overwhelming. It's around 410 of those 440 odd reactors are in these countries, okay? So there's a very clear, for if you want to look at it, you can see that there's a clear overlap, right? You can pretend, no, you don't need nuclear reactors to make nuclear weapons, and that is true. Israel is a country which does not have any nuclear power plants. North Korea is a country that does not have any nuclear power plants and has nuclear weapons. So you can make nuclear weapons without making nuclear reactors for generating electricity. But having a nuclear reactor for generating electricity helps you to make nuclear weapons, right? Brings you closer to the point where you can choose to make nuclear weapons. And there are three reasons for that overlap also. The first and one that I sort of alluded to is a technical overlap, right? So the steps that you need to go through in order to produce nuclear power from a nuclear reactor has a large overlap with what you have to do to make nuclear weapons materials, right? I've talked about the fact that sometimes if you build a nuclear power plant or a nuclear reactor of any kind, if it's fueled by uranium, automatically the process that that sort of produces the power in the nuclear in the reactor, the fission process, also will produce neutrons that some of them will be absorbed by the uranium, which will become plutonium. So all nuclear power plants will also produce plutonium. Most nuclear power plants around the world also require the use of slightly enriched uranium. So uranium in nature consists of two kinds of what are called isotopes, two varieties of uranium, and one of them is more useful to make both nuclear power and nuclear weapons, the lighter variety called uranium-235, but that's very rare in nature. And so you have to do a sort of complicated technical process called enrichment in order to increase the concentration of that. So in nature, uranium-235 is around 0.7%. So if you go and dig in the garden out here, you'll find some uranium that'll have about 0.7% or 7 parts in 1,000 of uranium-235, and the rest, 993 parts, will be uranium-238, right? If you want to make it into a nuclear power plant fuel, then that 0.7% has to go to about 3 to 5%. They are talking now about reactors that will use closer to 15 to 20%. For example, the reactor design that Bill Gates is promoting, so-called natrium design, that requires HALEU fuel. That's also going to be built, or it's planned to be built, in Wyoming. Anyway, so they require higher levels of enriched uranium. Now, to make a nuclear weapon, you'd have to go, you'd like to go to maybe 80 to 90% of the uranium-235. But the same process that gets you from 0.7% to 3% or 5%, if you just keep running the same process and sort of modify it slightly, you can go up to 80%, 90%. This is what Iran is doing, and this is what is sort of many people around the world are concerned about it, right? Iran's government says, no, we are not actually building nuclear weapons. The supreme leader has said there is a fatwa against making nuclear weapons, but nobody else believes them, right? Why? Because in principle, it's because Iran has the technology to enrich uranium, and they've shown that they have. And they're saying we can, you know, we were used to make 3%, now 5%, then 15%, then 50%, 60%. They can keep, they're going up the chain. And they're basically playing this game of sort of chicken, if you like, or whatever metaphor you want to use, to kind of say, we can make nuclear weapons, we are not doing it, but you guys need to negotiate with us. Okay. But underlying that diplomatic or the political calculation is the technical fact that what they are doing can provide a nuclear weapon to them. And that's the same process that can be used to make nuclear power plant fuel as well. So there's a strong technical connection. And in the case of plutonium, as I mentioned, all nuclear reactors will have some plutonium. Inside a reactor, the plutonium is surrounded by highly radioactive materials, other materials called fission products, right? Why are those products there? To put it simply, a nuclear power plant is basically a very complicated way to boil water using a very hazardous process. And that process, when the uranium nucleus fissions, it will produce lighter radioactive elements, which are hazardous to human health. And so the whole purpose of designing a nuclear power plant is to try and minimize the chances of that going out. And you're never going to bring that down to zero. That's why you have accidents every now and then. But that's also what drives the high cost and so on and so forth. But back to what I was saying, that's the purpose of a nuclear reactor in the design is to make sure that all these fission products, these radioactive materials, are sitting inside the fuel elements, inside which the plutonium is also there. So inside a fuel element, there is plutonium, but there's all this other very highly radioactive stuff, which can be lethal to anybody who's trying to handle it. So what in order to make a nuclear weapon, you have to go through a subsequent chemical process called reprocessing. That also happened in Hanford originally. And that chemical process is basically you break up this fuel, you dunk it into hot nitric acid, and then you use a bunch of other chemicals to separate out the uranium, the plutonium, et cetera, and you can produce the plutonium. And in the case of India, they did that under the pretext that they were going to use the plutonium to fuel nuclear reactors. And in a sense, it's correct. You can use the plutonium to fuel a nuclear reactor as well. But in fact, they actually use it to make nuclear weapons. And that's one of the ambiguities of nuclear power. If you can say, I'm going to try to use it to generate electricity, but you can also use the same process to produce nuclear weapons. Okay, so that's all the technical mumbo-jumbo that you have to sort of understand. Yeah, I'll be done in like 2 more minutes. So there's like 2 other elements that I think I'd like to mention. A lot of countries also have challenges in terms of having people trained to do all this work. If a random country in the world, I don't want to name any particular country, if they decide that they have to make nuclear weapons, they have to train a bunch of people in nuclear science, in metallurgy, in a whole bunch of other things. Some of that training overlaps with the training that you require to build, design, operate nuclear plants, right? And a good example for this is the case of Pakistan. So Pakistan too had all these interests in nuclear energy ever since it got independence, and seeing that India was setting up a nuclear program, they were particularly concerned. But they basically found that by the vicissitudes of colonial partition, most of the technical people ended up on the Indian side of the border. And one committee that was set up from Harvard University that looked at Pakistan said there are probably not more than 10 people who can actually understand nuclear technology in Pakistan. So you guys need to do something. What was Pakistan's answer to that? The Atoms for Peace program under Eisenhower. About 150 odd scientists and engineers came from Pakistan to the United States, got trained in nuclear technology, went back, and they were the people who formed the cadre that eventually produced nuclear weapons in Pakistan. Same story in Iran too, right? The Iranian nuclear program was set up with US help. It was done under the Shah in the 1970s. The Shah gave a bunch of money to MIT, and MIT set up a special program to train those people. Those people went back. Some of them were the ones who are using this. So that's the fourth connection. The last connection which I want to mention is that in all countries that develop nuclear power programs, there is usually some institution that is promoting that. So in the case of India, it was something called the Department of Atomic Energy. In the United States, the institution that is promoting nuclear power is the Department of Energy. Both those institutions are also the same ones that produce material for making nuclear weapons. In the US, it's the DOE that is in charge of a lot of the nuclear weapons activities. It is privatized and so on and so forth, but the DOE is the sort of government entity. In India, it's the same story. And in India, I think, is a more good example of how this works, because the DAE was, as I mentioned earlier, set up in order to promote atomic energy for peaceful purposes. But eventually, they realized there's a lot of political power to be had by also developing nuclear weapons. Because once they had the nuclear weapons, they had this kind of dual-faced argument. For those people who would say, oh, you know, nuclear energy is too expensive, you're not producing a lot of it, they'll say, oh, but we're also making the bomb, and that's going to make you very safe, right? And for those people who say, oh, no, India is a peaceful country, we have, you know, Mahatma Gandhi, and, you know, we want to be a good citizen in the world, they'll say, oh, but we also produce cheap electricity, right? In actual fact, they produce neither. They don't produce cheap electricity, they don't give you security, right? But it's a wonderful promise to be able to use to get all the political power that they want. So I'll just sort of end there. I know I've sort of talked a lot, but thank you. And I'm happy to talk more.
So I think we're gonna each go through and kind of talk a little bit more about how we can insert ourselves into the dialogue around nonproliferation and how that's connected to a lot of other things, nuclear, which you should pick up Romana's book. I also wrote a book on Hanford called Atomic Days. Forgot to mention that. That's in the bookstore. Haymarket published that a couple years ago. I think the two major conflicts right now that we talk about in the West, Ukraine and Gaza, are both nuclear issues. Of course, and Russia does have nuclear weapons, but there's another aspect to that conflict that we don't talk about a lot, which is Zaporizhia and other plants in the region that are in the conflict zone that are now being used as bargaining chips and tools of war. That has never, it's unprecedented. There's never been an operating nuclear plant in a war zone like this before. Zaporizhia is on the brink of a meltdown. When you have the heads of the IAEA talking about this is a threat, you know it's a threat. This is an agency that is in charge of promoting nuclear technology, and they're scared. We should be scared too. And a lot of people, there is this portion on the left, I like to call them the Star Trek left, that believe this technology will save us. They believe nuclear technology will save the climate. They don't like to address the connection to weapons. They don't like to talk about the impact on native lands. They don't like to talk about the risks for future generations. They don't like to talk about the risks to us now. They'll downplay Chernobyl or Fukushima and say that these radiation and these accidents had very little impact. They will go on to tell you that the accidents in the future will not happen because the reactors are designed differently. But at the very core, the technology has not changed. The accidents will remain, and we can't predict the future. We cannot ever predict what will happen in a region 100 years, 200 years, 300 years from now. Will there be a conflict in that region? I mean, right now, Taiwan has, I think, I don't know, 5 or 6 plants. They plan to phase those out in the next couple of years. But who's to say that there's not going to be a conflict in Taiwan tomorrow, right? How are we going to, who's going to promise me that that can't be used as a tool of war in a conflict between the US and China in Taiwan? Nobody. And even when those plants are not operating anymore, the waste that they've produced for the last few decades they've been operating will remain. Those waste tanks will also potentially be a target. Dimona in Israel could be a target by an Iranian strike. This can go on and on and on. Hanford in Eastern Washington State could be a target if Canada gets really pissed at us. It's funny now, right? Those kind of scenarios, but also they're unpredictable. We don't know what's gonna be happening 200 years from now. I mean, the lifespan of plutonium being radioactive is 240,000 years. Humans have been roaming outside of Africa for what, 60 to 80,000 years, right? This is beyond. We don't even know how to communicate the dangers to future generations. So I think these are very important conversations for us to have because they impact people today, but they also impact generations in the future. And if we're concerned about climate change, if we're concerned about nuclear catastrophe, we ought to be having these conversations in rooms like this. They start like this because it's about the future of the planet and planetary health, which transcends human health. This is about planetary health. It's about ecosystems. This is what sustains us as a species. And I think that that's a really important part of this conversation, and I'm happy that we're having it.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about anti-nuclear organizing against nuclear weapons internationally. We have a really robust transnational campaign. A lot of the work that we do here in the different struggles we're part of, I often hear from folks about how we need to be more transnational, international, and global in our work. And I always think about the anti-nuclear movement because I think it's one of the best cases that we have of really working across borders. imperfect, but always trying. And so one of the recent campaigns was to abolish nuclear weapons, prohibit nuclear weapons under international law, to put them on the same footing as chemical weapons, biological weapons, landmines, cluster bombs, all of these weapons that activists, survivors, affected communities, and governments have found to be unacceptable. And so we worked with governments at the United Nations to develop a treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. This took many, many years, as you can imagine, but it was adopted at the UN in 2017, and it entered into force in 2021, and it has a lot of states' parties. It does not have currently any nuclear armed states on board yet. They hate the treaty. They tried to prevent it from being negotiated, which also was a good sign we were doing the right thing. They claim it has no effect, but actually it is already having an effect in specific ways, I think most notably in terms of divestment. And I think that's also the one that's probably the most interesting for folks in this room working on Israel-Palestine and other issues. So we, even before the treaty was negotiated, we started contacting some of these financial institutions that I mentioned earlier that have investments in the companies that make nuclear weapons. And what they would say is, well, nuclear weapons aren't illegal, so these, we don't need to include nuclear weapons in like our ethical investment strategies. So that was part of our impetus for going and banning nuclear weapons. Then we came back to these same financial institutions, and many of them said, yep, okay, these are now illegal under international law, so we will now divest. And what we're seeing is, even in countries that don't yet support the treaty, government pension funds, banks, financial investment institutions are actually pulling their money out of portfolios that include nuclear weapon producing companies. So obviously, with the hundreds of billions of dollars still being invested in these companies, we have a long way to go. But I raise it as a thing that I think is interesting because of the relationship between the nuclear weapon producing companies and the companies that are making the weapons, as I said earlier, that are going to commit genocide and fueling conflict around the world in many, many areas. And so the work that we've done through the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons, ICAN, through our divestment work, through the work, we call it Don't Bank on the Bomb as well. There's a lot of different ways in which we could be collaborating more with different movements that are also working on divestment from weapon companies here in the US and elsewhere in the world. I also want to talk a little bit about direct action, because I think we've seen so many great examples of that in the context of Israel's genocide. And there's been less direct action in recent memory when it comes to nuclear weapons, but there is actually a rich history of it. In Nevada, folks used to go get arrested regularly blocking the tests that the United States would do, nuclear bomb tests. I call them tests, but that's the words that's used, but they're not tests. They're actual explosions of nuclear weapons that contaminated the United States, contaminated the world. We all have nuclear radioactive material in our bodies from those tests that were done in Nevada, hundreds of them. The Western Shoshone, whose land that is, are the most bombed nation on Earth. I think over 800 nuclear weapons were tested in the Nevada desert. So folks used to do some incredible direct action around that. The Catholic workers have an excellent history of going into nuclear weapon production facilities or different fuel processing plants, breaking in and spilling blood on the machinery. There's a great book about the Luddites called Blood in the Machine, and I also think about that when I'm thinking about the work that the nuns have done. So there is this rich tradition of it that we haven't seen a lot of in recent years, that I think we have some learning to do from the amazing actions that have taken place around weapon production companies like Elbit Systems and others supplying weapons to Israel, actions at the ports that are shipping these weapons. And again, there's connections to be made between our movements against violence in all of these different manifestations. Very recently, on the Navajo Nation, I know Janine can speak to this much more than I can, there was transit of nuclear material without permission through the Navajo Nation, and amazing direct actions to stop those shipments. So yeah, I'm hopeful that in our conversations again here and elsewhere throughout this conference and beyond, that we can be thinking of more ways to collaborate, because this is all part of the same structure of state violence that we're up against.
I'll just piggyback a couple of points on what Josh and Ray mentioned. The first is on Israel's nuclear weapons, and I think that's a point that we should all be pushing towards, and especially given that there is a lot of rhetoric about Iran's nuclear program, and pointing out the hypocrisy of sanctioning Iran while supplying, you know, the billions and billions and billions of dollars of arms to Israel, I think is something we should be carrying out. The challenge there is, you know, I'm going to differ slightly from Josh in saying when, in the 1979, when the test happened in the South Atlantic, the test was detected by a satellite called the Vela satellite. And what happened was the test was supposed to have happened when there was rain and there was clouds, and for better or for worse, at the time when the explosion happened, the cloud cover opened up a little bit. And so there was a flash. When a nuclear weapons test happens, there's a characteristic sort of dual peak in the light that comes out. And that was detected by the Vela satellite. Now, the US government has a lot of smart lawyers. And so what they basically said was, we will set up a panel to try and absolve Israel of this. And so they reached out, and the person who headed the panel was a professor at MIT. He was retired by the time I was a postdoc there, but he still used to come there, Jack Luina. And what they basically told the panel was, can you find any possible way by which the satellite could have mistakenly identified this as a test, all right? That's all they were told through. And they, of course, went and said, oh, you know, if this particular chip were to fail and that has to happen, then yes, the satellite could mistakenly think there's a test. Right? Now, in the decades since then, we have found radionuclides in South Australia, in Australia, absorbed by sheep and so on and so forth, that proves that there was a test there. So there's other evidence for that test. But as far as the US government is concerned, they can say there was no test, right? But that's something which I think we can actually open up again. And there have been people also, you know, from the mainstream, you know, liberal establishment who have been trying to do this. And so there are some allies there. On the nuclear power question, I'll just say very briefly that there is, like Ray mentioned, there is an international group of people who are sort of trying to fight this expansion of nuclear power. And to some extent, we are getting our asses kicked because the other side has so much more money, right? And so they have mounted a very effective propaganda campaign, which kind of tells that, you know, nuclear is the only solution to climate change and so on and so forth. What we have on our side is reality, right? You know, they've been trying to build nuclear plants for decades, and it just sort of creeps up, you know, one reactor gets built, four of them get shut down, that kind of stuff, right? So if you look at the number of nuclear plants around the world, they were built mostly in the 70s and 80s, and after Chernobyl, essentially the number has been more or less constant, right? Goes up a little bit, comes down a little bit, right? So it's been more or less there. But if you think about a different metric, which is how much do nuclear power plants around the world contribute to the electricity supply around the world? That fraction has been declining consistently since the mid-1990s. So in the mid-1990s, it was about 17.5%. In 2023, it was around little over 9%. Okay, so it's roughly about half of what it was in the mid-1990s. And that is declining. At best, if they throw in lots of money, they can kind of maintain that share. But really, just because each of these reactors takes such a long time to build, it's so expensive, that they really can't do that. Whereas the other main sort of solution to climate change, quote unquote, renewables, has been growing much, much faster. So the renewable share of electricity used to be close to zero in the mid-1990s and is now around 15%, right? So that's growing very fast. And that's because you can install a solar plant or a wind turbine much more quickly than you can do a nuclear plant and for much more lower cost. And so in the race, as it were, nuclear, those facts are on our side, so to say. But the political battle is a very difficult one. And I wish I knew what to do about it, except, you know, ask people for lots of money and hire lots of people to do this kind of work, which we're not going to get, unfortunately.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.